Mormon Mental Health Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and relies on donations from its listeners like you. To help keep this podcast alive, please consider becoming a monthly subscriber. Any amount will make a difference. You can click the right-hand donate button on mormonmentalhealth.org. All contributions are tax-deductible within the United States and go towards podcast production and building community support and program development for Mormons on various paths and journeys. Thank you for listening.
The following is video taken from a presentation Jimmy Bridges did while at the 2019 MOCAN Annual Conference held in Overland Park, Kansas, March 22nd and 23rd of 2019. Jimmy Bridges is a couples and family therapy PhD student at Kansas State University studying queer Mormon populations, while his clinical work mainly focuses on couples working and engaging men in the therapy process. He is also a clinician for Symmetry Solutions. Please visit SymmetrySouls.com to find out more about Jimmy and Symmetry Solutions. Jimmy has given Mormon Mental Health permission to broadcast his presentation. Please enjoy the episode.
Set up with a practice called Symmetry Solutions based out of Wichita, Kansas, directed by Natasha Parker here. I want to just like briefly outline some of the main outcomes that I want to have happen today. First, I want to just introduce all of you to some of the more up-to-date research on the intersection of these two identities of queer and conservative religious. So that's where all of this research is focusing on. So there's research on sexual and gender minorities within affirming religious settings, but most of the research when it comes to mental health looks at sexual and gender minorities within conservative religious groups because of the dissonance, because of the often the difficult experiences they have in settings like that, in communities and upbringings like that. So that's kind of situated in kind of my context. So I want to provide that information, but I want to apply this stuff in like a clinical case kind of way. So once I do ask for all of you to get into different groups, try to be with, you know, at least two or three. There's no limit though. And the best way to probably do that would be for turning and like meeting up like that, as opposed to trying to do that along the rows for your own description. Just maybe turn your desks and group up with people behind you. And then mostly I just want to provide some guidance into assessment, different kinds of assessment strategies and different questions to consider that may not be as obvious for folks raised in conservative religious groups. Before I do that, or before we like just dive right in, I want to talk about me, because positionality, so this is a term that basically talks about the social identities of researchers and clinicians and how that interacts and affects the populations or the clients that we're interacting with. And so me as a researcher, as a clinician, if I'm thinking about my social identities, I'm like, when it comes to social status and privilege, I'm like, you know, way up there. And that matters to me because my lens, this is like my lens, if we're going to think of it like that. So my lens is a white, straight, heterosexual, cisgender male, more like I'm heading towards upper class as a PhD student, and that all matters in how I interpret, whether that's a client's story, how I interpret the data that I'm collecting and how I'm analyzing it. All of that matters, and I have to be very aware of that. So a large part of my research has been influenced by my therapeutic stance and just therapy in general. So we typically, I'm hearing this often, I do research on and I do therapy with. So community-based participatory research, this is a field that is trying to change the academic environment to be more community-based in how we're doing our research. And this is a big influence for me. in my research, I've been trying to consider ways in which I can engage my participants in the research process. And I'm talking about quantitative research. So a lot of this has impacted my work, making sure that I have folks that identify with the populations that I'm studying on my research team, or having folks that identify with my participants' identities actually look over my manuscript. And it's kind of anxiety provoking, because I don't identify with my participants, and a part of this is giving more autonomy to the participants so they become co-constructors in the knowledge production process. Okay, Curious George. So my daughter absolutely is obsessed with Curious George, and it's just a little analogy that I like to make, and it's a good reminder for me of how I approach my clinical work, but also how I approach my research. I do try to remain as flexible as possible. So I step into a topic, an intersection topic like sexuality and religion, based on how I've been raised, based on what position I'm coming from. I started off like this. I had a lot of assumptions going into this work. I had, and along the way, I've had to correct those from feedback from the participants in the community, the Mormon community. So most of my work is looking at members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and Mormon, probably saying Mormon from now on, and post-Mormon, so those who have left the church. And the feedback has really pushed me to reconsider some of my assumptions and stuff like that. So I want to go back to this. I said about my positionality. At 19, well, back up even further, I was Buddhist in high school. I joined the LDS Church, Mormon Church, at 19, served a two-year mission in Arizona, and about, like, in the last 5 years, I started asking probably more questions than my leaders were comfortable in me asking, and church leaders, I mean, and I kind of put one foot in and one foot out and adhere a lot to the Unitarian Universalist frameworks of faith. And at this point, I don't know how to identify religiously or spiritually. I don't know how to explain who I am. So I put you in Mormon to simplify that. So, okay, we're going to do a little activity. So if you can all get your phones out. If you can all, contact that you're going to put in is Jimmy Bridges 388. And you're going to text 22333 to that contact. So, and once you do that, it'll probably say, like, you've joined. I want you, it's kind of like a word association. So we're going to make a wordle here. So the contact, Jimmy Bridges, 388. And you text 22333. And once you're in, I want you to come up with, just enter in words. When you think of when the religious and LGBT communities come together, what words come to mind?
Religious and LGBTQ communities.
Yeah. So this is more of a question that I'm wanting to tap into the social narratives that you find in your world out there.
Even if they're contradictory.
Okay, so conflict's the biggest one. I see confused, contradictory, questions. I like that. Identity, incompatible, growing. Some of these I expected, some of these I didn't. That's me. I appreciate it. Wow, that was... So, like I said, think of, just to remember that the context in which I'm drawing all these theories and this literature from is research done from conservative religious groups looking at sexual gender minorities within those contexts. So these three theories kind of make up a lot of the literature and really guide a lot of this. Cognitive dissonance theory, that idea of, you know, you're working on your current framework, you come to new knowledge, and it creates dissonance. It's that experience can often be, I mean, that frankly, like earth-shattering. It can be, it can cause stress and whatnot. So crash theory is something that I actually recently came upon about a year and a half ago. Rabbi B'nai Lapi, who was raised in an Orthodox Jewish background, when it came into a Reform Jewish faith framework and came out as lesbian during that process, and she developed her own theory as to how this kind of looks and how it looked for her, and it has some generalizability. There's no, like, data behind this, but she has two TED Talks on it, and I really loved it. It emphasizes choice and how we choose to hold on to different parts of our identity. And these models often end with the most difficult choice and option of integration. And so reconciliation strategy theory, which is more just like typologies, looks at those who reject their religious identity, hold on to their LGBTQ identity, and really affirm and embrace that part of themselves. Those that reject their LGBTQ identity and hold on to their religious beliefs in the original orthodoxy that they raise. And then there's compartmentalization, the compartmentalizers. And this is really trying to live both of those worlds at different times. So if I'm in my religious congregation, in that space, I don't talk about being gay. I don't talk about gender dysphoria. I just live there. When I'm in the queer community, I don't talk about my religion. I leave that on Sunday. And then there's the fourth reconciliation strategy of integration. This is where there's a successful integrating ability for both identities to come together. There's often a lot of faith framework reworking that goes into that ability to do that.
I'm so sorry. So I know that this is directly around religious identity. Would this theory, would it also work with how they see themselves, such as race or anything else like that? I mean, with the reconciliation, because I mean, I know with a lot of different cultures, like it doesn't align with LGBTQ. Does this directly relate to religious identity, or could it also be used with other identities that we have?
I can't answer that on the basis of, because I don't have a lot of knowledge in race identity development. I'm sure there's some parallels, but sorry.
No, thank you.
It's a good question, though, and I appreciate you just asking me and not waiting till the end. I like that. Okay, I'm going to jump more into the specific research on this. There's actually very little on genderqueer, trans, and religious conservative identity conflict. And it's growing, and I think that's just the nature of the times. The literature that we do have talks about that participants, at least in this study, from Levy and Lowe, and these folks are out of Appalachian State, experiencing keeping their dissonance a secret, struggling with their spiritual and religious beliefs, which is kind of mirrored in sexual minority experiences as well, and depression, isolation, feeling oppressed and rejected. When integration is able to happen, like I said earlier, there's often a faith framework reworking that has to happen, personalizing of their faith, and which is very common for sexual and gender minorities. If they want to hold on to those core beliefs that they still feel deeply about. So moving into sexual minority, so there's just a ton more research on sexual minority, religious integration, and reconciliation. So right here, there's just a list from Dahl and Gallagher. They do a lot of work on this, and these are just main kind of religious integration things that really come up to the top, and one of those was self-acceptance. Knowledge of religious teachings, and then the support from family and friends. Successful integration really depends on these things. For what changes occur in religious faith framework when integration is attempted, you move more towards spiritual as opposed to religious. And just based on clinical experiences, I think that has more to do with coming away from doctrine and moving more towards personal relationships with deity or spirituality, which is more individualized. Reinterpreted religious teachings, no longer identifying with the religion at all. These are some that float to the top. Okay, so we've talked, so you've mentioned affirming and non-affirming. I appreciate you mentioning this. All of the cartoons that you're gonna see come from David Hayward. He's a cartoonist who's commenting a lot on these issues, but on religion, kind of in general. Just wanted to give a shout out to him. He let me use his cartoons, he's a really nice guy. So, non-affirming settings, this is stuff by Barnes and Meyer. They found that internalized homophobia just amped up in non-affirming settings for sexual minorities. So when I say non-affirming, just to give a definition out, I mean religious organizations that condemn same-sex unions, that prohibit leadership members who identify as sexual gender minorities, and sometimes, if depending on the extremity, there's kind of a effort to quench any coming out that ends up happening in non-affirming settings. And affirming settings, opposite, the celebration, affirmation of same-sex unions, of leadership that are LGBTQ, but also even a incorporation of queering theology in the organization. So the Human Rights Campaign actually came up with an entire list of affirming and non-affirming main religious organizations. On there, they list off all the main, at least like U.S. and Canada-based, main position statements taken from the religious organizations and where they stand on these issues. So I use this when a client comes to me and they tell me I'm from Southern Baptist Convention, faith movement background, or I'm from United Church of Christ, and, you know, so that helps orient me what this means for them in terms of, especially in terms of how strong faith was in their family and upbringing. Human Rights Campaign, it's pretty easy to find. And this kind of moves into, so when we're talking about non-affirming settings, religious abuse is a thing. So this is the kind of use of coercion, shaming, manipulation tactics, often used to try and, you could say, coerce someone into a certain way of thinking. The extreme versions of this, when when church leaders are using conversion therapy tactics in their offices. There's a lot of research done. Lee Beckstead is a big leader in the conversion, in kind of assessing, and John DeLynn kind of just assessing what these folks that have been through conversion therapy, what's been their experience, and religious abuse often comes up. So when we think about young adults, because a lot of this research focuses a lot on young adults and youth, the coming out and the sexual minority identity awareness often acts as a catalyst for a new kind of faith development or just a faith crisis. And there's a few kind of, you could say, like positive and negative outcomes that the literature talks about in terms of what it's like when that catalyst sets off a whole change in faith and religious belief. So sometimes there's an increased sense of self, social support. If there's social support there, that helps with that kind of integration and faith crisis. And if there's a successful integration, there can be an incorporation of religious values into their identity as a sexual minority or gender minority. When faith crisis or transition happens, negative outcomes include inadequacy, religious-related guilt, depression, and strain, especially social strain. So the cartoon, I think, really does a good job at this. If you're thinking about, especially these folks who are coming from more orthodox or fundamental faith backgrounds, it's often looked at as backsliding. And the individual, the sexual minority or gender minority individual, thinking, no, I have to leave, in at least proximity-wise, I have to step out of this church, and I've even heard, because God wants me to integrate my faith with my sexuality, but not in the way that my faith or my family is telling me to. So this kind of displays it pretty well. Okay, so I'm going to get into a little bit of my research, and then we're going to get into groups. I think that's how I planned it. So, like I said, my research looks at Mormons and post-Mormons, so those who have left the church, and those who stay in. And specifically, I focus on those who identify as sexual minorities with labels. And I say that because not everybody who is Mormon, or even or especially active Mormon, and who is a sexual minority, calls himself lesbian, gay, bisexual, so on and so forth. Explain that a bit. Same-sex attracted, and it's not just a Mormon phenomenon. I've heard this talked about in other conservative religious circles. There is a history in our church of promoting the use of the label of same-sex attracted as opposed to using the labels of the LGBTQ community. So Dallin H. Chokes is currently a leader of the LDS Church, and in 95 he said this: though the church now uses labels like gay, homosexual, which has issues with that word in itself, but like with online resources, the use of the word, at least on higher levels, is used. The community still has this huge, huge trend of using this word same-sex attracted, and it kind of comes from this culture. So he said in 95, we should note that the words homosexual, lesbian, and gay are adjectives to describe particular thoughts, feelings, or behaviors. We should refrain from using these words as nouns to identify particular conditions or specific persons. So it's a strong recommendation that you keep your religious identity in the forefront. And your sexual, your same-sex attractions, and any gender dysphoria, stays as kind of something, a trial you've been given, thing you have to overcome, as opposed to an identity you take on. So my research, like I said, I looked at those who label themselves with LGBT labels. And then I looked at the differences between those who are still affiliated with the LDS Church and those who had left. So my main outcomes were suicidality, anxiety, and life satisfaction. And granted, these are just independent sample t-tests, group differences, and I'll get into a structural equation model later that controls for all factors. So first with women, and the women and men have similar things. Women, they were just lower sample size, but I think that affected it. Anxiety and suicidality, there's higher anxiety and suicidality report scores for those sexual minority women in the church as opposed to out. So I use these variables, LGBT self-acceptance, internalized homo negativity, and outness as a way to kind of gauge how affirming they were of themselves in this identity of theirs, and showed up the same, this is our hypothesis, is that those who were no longer in the church would have higher scores of identity affirmation, sexual identity affirmation, and that showed up true as well. And then sexual identity support, LGBT community support and need support, was higher for those who had left the church. And the same thing for men. So this is gay and bisexual men, lesbian and bisexual women. The same kind of things show. So we put all that into a structural equation model and control for LDS affiliation and those different forms of social support. It turned out that social support, sexual identity support, needs connection support really became the most important predictors of those mental health outcomes. So the more sexual identity support, the more affirming the space is for sexual and gender minorities, for sexual minorities, the better off they are, regardless of if they're in the LDS Church or not, or they're still affiliated or not. But that is just so crucial, that there's actual support for their identity that's an affirming space. So I want to share with you an actual story. I might share just this one. So this is Anne. Anne is a trans woman in the queer Mormon community. She is very out about her story. She actually posted her story on a kind of like a support group for queer Mormons called North Star. And they did a series of stories. And Anne talks about her story, her coming out, her upbringing. And I just highlighted the points that I think are more salient for the topic today. I was born into a strong LDS family in Salt Lake City, Utah. At the age of 7, I had a clear realization that I did not feel I was a boy. But I also knew that I didn't look like a girl either. Both my bishop and therapist took the approach that this was an addiction and my behavior must be stopped by means of prayer and self-control techniques. Throughout all my teen years, I continued to meet with my bishop. We were still treating my dressing and female clothing as an addiction. I persistently prayed to Heavenly Father, asking Him to take this away from me and to heal me. I had faith that if I was doing what was asked of me, one day the Lord would make me whole, and the feelings of confusion with my gender would be gone. I was convinced that going on a mission would eliminate my gender dysphoria. I couldn't have been more wrong. I was released from my service for medical reasons and returned home. As a young adult, one night, I knelt by my bed and pleaded with my Heavenly Father. I told Him that I knew my desires were righteous and I only wanted to do what was expected of me. I knew He could do all things and that my only desire was to be made whole. I spent so much energy and emotion praying that I eventually collapsed with exhaustion. Immediately, I realized that I had not been healed, and I was devastated. Nothing had changed. I was angry, and I felt abandoned. All of my negative feelings were directed towards God. I still had a testimony of the gospel, but I no longer believed God cared about me. If He did care about me, He would have healed me and made me whole. Those were her words, and I kind of just summarized. Anne later married, adopted their first child due to her wife's infertility complications, and her wife continue to work through normal and unique challenges of family life. And Anne continues to work through reconciliation of past and present identities as a transgender woman. The longer story is, if you want it, I could send it to you. It's really powerful. It's a moving story. So here's another one. This individual asked to be anonymous. This was her word, so we'll call her Olivia. Olivia identifies as a bisexual Mormon woman, or not sure, Mormon woman, currently. So this is her story, or part of her story. Growing up as a bisexual woman in the Mormon church, I always believed I was sinful. I was attracted to female friends of mine starting around age 12, but remember consciously thinking that I needed to pretend like those attractions were made up. I didn't have language for my sexual identity until college. I remember one summer at a week-long church camp, especially for you, or EFY, I had met a really cool girl and developed what was definitely a crush on her. I also learned at this church camp that masturbation was the sin next to murder. I set up multiple appointments with my bishop to confess every instance of masturbation in great detail in order to receive forgiveness. I also confessed all the experiences I had with female friends that had aroused me. These meetings were incredibly uncomfortable, especially because I did not have the option to talk to another woman about these experiences. Feeling aroused automatically meant I would have to sit with the discomfort of feeling aroused, which meant feeling disgusted with myself, risk sinning and masturbating, have to confess to a man about it, feel guilty enough to feel forgiven, and then the cycle would repeat itself over and over again. This conditioning was so consistent that to this day I have to combat feelings of guilt, shame, or dread any time I feel sexually aroused to women. In an attempt to reconcile the damage that was caused by extensive self-loathing and shame during some of my most formative years, I've had to step away from my religion of origin to give my space, to give myself space to feel. Really powerful. Mm-hmm. And heartbreaking. And these people are courageous. Okay, so a little bit on family, in terms of some of the research on family, sexual minority religious settings. Inclusive family climates, this kind of goes back to our deepest support. Help identity integration the most. When those family supports aren't there, it says parental anti-homosexual beliefs associated with chronic suicidal thoughts of kids. And for this particular study, two of the main indicators with a suicide attempt in the last year was leaving one's religion and parents' religious beliefs against homosexual life. This was significant for the sample that they looked at. Okay, so this is group time. So I want you to get into groups, and this is the vignette. So I'm going to read it out loud, and then there's going to be some scaffolding right after the slide. So an opposite sex, cisgender couple, married 8 years with 3 children, comes to you seeking counseling. So they have recently stopped attending the church they were both raised in. The wife shares 2 months ago she told her husband that she is sexually attracted to women, but is still confused about this. Husband has expressed desires to start attending church again for the kid's spiritual well-being. A lot of these are based on cases that I've had and cases that other providers that I consult with have had. So I'm not making this stuff up. So the first thing I want you all to discuss is what are potential narratives you might hear if you allowed society to do a commentary on this couple and the presenting issue. So what are some main kind of societal narratives that might come in to explain kind of what's going on here? So,
do you want us to talk in groups?
Yeah. So at least groups of 2 or 3, but it can be as many as 5 or 6 or whatever. Just suggestions, and I've themed them out into 3 categories. Identity. How does a sexual minority partner feel about their own sexual identity? And some of you have kind of, you probably talked about these and kind of just repeating them, but I heard somewhere over here, what does that even mean? LGBTQ.
You said that, right?
So, how do they understand what that
where did that come from? Like, how do they define it?
Yeah. So, this is what I run into, at least with my own clinical experience, understanding how the straight spouse understands what sexual identity is, and sexual fluidity, and labels, and process of coming out. How well does a straight spouse understand what that's all about? Religion, what are the consequences of making this public in their own religious space? what aspects of their faith or religious practice do they still hold on to, even if they no longer attend? So that's kind of what we're getting at here. Level of religious orthodoxy for each partner's family and all the family members that they're close with. And sometimes extended family is, yeah. Level of orthodoxy for each partner prior to disconnecting from church and currently. Getting a really good sense, especially, you know, depending on where they're coming from. And the religious, and I talked about before, the human rights campaign. Getting a sense of the religious organization's stance, sexual minority identities. Or in future, how they talked about the influence of their faith transition on their kids, and what that means for their kids, if any faith framework starts to change, but they still want their kids to have the good parts, you know, of their faith upbringing. What support system is like, talked about before, how strongly connected support is, strong relationships between support and mental health and well-being, so things to consider. So main takeaways, compounded amounts of discrimination, which can impact identity formation and well-being. So it's a multi-layered thing. We have discrimination and health disparities for sexual and gender minorities, regardless of who you are in the United States. You add on top of that a conservative religious group and any family that might not be as supportive if they're coming from the same conservative religious group that's not affirming. And you get this compounded effect that without the right supports, it becomes, this is sensitive, this is sometimes very time sensitive, has to be considered. So this is, for at least my work with queer Mormons or post-Mormons, identity work is big. You know, I've heard a lot of that being talked about. Self-acceptance and self-image and who I am as a sexual minority based on this religious identity that shaped who I was. Katie, you were saying it's who you are growing up. And now that this new information comes that I am gay or I might not be a man, that's significant. And this is kind of where I conclude. Based on research, my own clinical experiences, the deconstruction of our beliefs and the rebuilding is just so much a part of this work when you are working with sexual and gender minorities who come from these backgrounds. The comic, I just want to read it out loud because I love it. It's the deconstruction of your belief service center. Are you sure you want to do this? You may feel numb, angry, depressed. You may lose friends and your family. And your family will think you've lost it. But in the long run, if you hang in there, you will find peace. Ready? Thank you.
Thanks for joining us today on Mormon Mental Health Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please help us and become a monthly subscriber at mormonmentalhealth.org. The goals of this podcast include education, advocacy, and the mental health and general well-being of Mormons and their families. We can't further this work without your support. Music for this episode was provided by the Lower Lights.
Overlast, tempestuous sea, charred and compass. Came from thee, Jesus, Savior, pilot me, unknown ways before me roll, hiding rock and treacherous shore. Chart and compass came from thee, Jesus, Savior, pilot me. Sober,
Peaceful rest.
Then while he